Today on Wings, Rachel Maines, the scholar who unearthed the history of the vibrator.
It is illegal to sell vibrators for sexual purposes in Texas. If you want to go out and buy a gun so you can shoot up a church in Fort Worth, why, there's no problem. But we were discussing the difficulties of committing a mass murder with a vibrator. You'd have to have a lot of batteries.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Rachel Maines is a historian of technology whose scholarly activities have led her down some unexpected paths. In the autumn of 1999, she spoke about her studies on the history of the vibrator, which she chronicles in her book, The Technology of Orgasm.
This kind of blew me away. I discovered that the vibrator is the fifth electrical appliance to be introduced into the home. I was doing research on, of all subjects, needlework history, which sounds pretty dull, doesn't it? But I was working on the question of why there is such a huge rise in needlework publishing between 1880 and 1920, which then sort of tapers off and goes into a decline. And it looks as if it's correlated with women's employment. And I was trying to figure out exactly how this worked. And there's no bibliographic access to needlework magazines. There's no reader's guide to needlework literature. If you want to find out what was going on in needlework, you had to just sit there with your modern Priscilla and Woman's Home Companion and American Needlewoman and turn the pages. Well, I don't know how many of you have ever had a chance to look at turn-of-the-century magazines, but they have all these wild ads in them. Things that would be illegal to sell now, you know, like cures for alcoholism that were like 80% alcohol, and they had all these other things in them like cocaine. You know, some people are anti-regulation. You'll be glad for the Pure Food Drug Act if you look at a few of those. But one of the things that I noticed is very early on we see vibrators, and they're advertised in terms like all the pleasures of youth will throb within you. Thrilling, penetrating, invigorating, you know, and you think, At first I thought I just had a dirty mind. I thought, no. But I did write down the references, and I kept that in mind. And then after I got my doctoral degree, I decided I would try to find out why the vibrator appears as early as it does. The order of electrical appliances is, we have the introduction of the electric light bulb in 1876. About 13 years later, we have the electrification of the sewing machine, followed in the next few years by the fan, the tea kettle, the toaster, and the vibrator, in that order. Woman does not live by toast alone. It's the first personal care appliance to be introduced into the home. And this seemed to me very odd, that here we have this undeveloped electrical industry, and what are they trying to sell? They're trying to sell vibrators. And the first home-use electrical vibrator was invented in 1899. So this is still the 19th century, during this passionless period when women aren't supposed to have these animal urges. So I got interested in how this had come about. Who invented it, and why did they think they had invented this? Well, what I found out surprised me even more, which was that doctors had been performing a procedure since the time of Hippocrates in the 4th century BC, which was a massage of the vulva to produce a crisis of a disease called, quote, hysteria, unquote, which means womb disease. This crisis was called the hysterical paroxysm, and it was likened to the breaking of a fever. You know how you have a fever and suddenly, you know, you break out in a sweat and then you start to recover? Well, it was supposed to be like that, except that hysteria was a chronic disease and it was incurable, but it could be treated. So women would go regularly to the doctor, and, you know, they would lie down and they would be massaged until this crisis occurred, and then they would sit up. Oh, thank you, doctor, I needed that. And they would go home. Now, from the doctor's point of view, there's hardly anything better than a patient who's not sick and is therefore never going to either recover or die of the disease, but who's got to be treated regularly, right? What could be better than that? Hysteria was defined from very early times until the time of Freud as the revolt of the uterus against neglect, that it wasn't getting enough sex, enough satisfaction. Let's make a very clear distinction here between sex and satisfaction. And if it was not properly soothed with these massage treatments, that it would get up and start wandering around the body. Now, I don't know how many of you have seen or heard of Thomas LeCure's book, The Making of the Modern Body, but until amazingly recently, the uterus was thought to be a mobile organ. Now, obviously, anybody you know who does a dissection of a human body can see that the uterus is very securely attached to the pelvis. But Plato described it as an animal within an animal. And doctors used to think that it got up and it crawled around the body, you know, get up in her neck and choke her, you know, go down her arm and cause arm pain. It was just absolutely hilarious to me, to a modern reader. But nevertheless, that's what they thought. So you had to sort of tame the thing. And you would attract it back into its proper place in the pelvis by using these fragrant oils and this massage treatment, which was often done by midwives and not by the doctors themselves. There were very detailed instructions, and instructions which are in Latin, by the way, so that the average person would not have access to the information. And in fact, they didn't. In fact, some scholars didn't even know about the literature in Latin until fairly recently. And the instructions say, you know, put the fingers of one hand in here, and the other fingers of the other hand go on top, and here's what you do, and here's what's supposed to happen. You know, she'll breathe heavily, and she'll get all red. You know, and then there'll be these contractions, and there'll be this rush of fluid, and then she'll feel a whole lot better. But, of course, you'll have to come back next week. We don't know how many doctors actually did this. We just know that this was a treatment out there, and some very famous doctors like Thomas Sydenham, Ambrose Paré, and William Harvey, circulation of the blood, William Harvey, all wrote about it. Sydenham said that hysteria was the most common of all diseases except fevers. And when you consider that the common cold is a fever, we're talking about a lot of people with hysteria. Well, what I am suggesting in my book is that these women were actually suffering from what we would probably now call horniness. And then naturally they suffered from sleeplessness and anxiety and a feeling of heaviness in the abdomen. These were all supposed to be symptoms of hysteria. And that, of course, the pelvic congestion of this condition was relieved by orgasm, naturally. I mean, what else, right? What a surprise, you know. And of course, the symptoms would be exactly as described, and the recovery would be exactly as described. And what I'm suggesting here is that it's been discovered over and over again, both in modern and in earlier times, that only about 30% of women actually achieve orgasm with penetration alone. Well, that's less than a third. And that means that the other 70%, the majority of women, are not satisfied by penetration alone. And in the androcentric definition of sexuality, we all know what the androcentric definition of sexuality is. You know, it's the penetration hypothesis as the central idea of sexuality. Okay, here we've got these doctors doing this treatment. And you have to ask yourself, of course, what do the doctors think they're doing? What is it exactly that these doctors believe about what they're doing? Well, some of them know what they're doing. I found two. I found a Nathaniel Highmore in the 17th century. I think he's 1653. And he just says, this is an orgasm, guys. I mean, you can call it anything you want. You can call it an hysterical paroxysm. You can call it a crise vénérienne. You can call it anything you want, but it's an orgasm. And, you know, you've got to do this because it's your job. She's sick. She's not feeling well. And it's your job to produce this if her husband can't do it for her. Some doctors recommended marriage to single women who had hysteria, and then were surprised when it didn't work as a treatment. Other doctors recommended horseback riding. It was not recommended for men unless they were having trouble with impotence. And premature ejaculation, those guys were not supposed to ride horses at all. They were supposed to go around in carriages, and they were supposed to be very well-sprung carriages so they wouldn't get bounced too much. But the women were supposed to go in the carriages that bounced a lot, and there were swings. And when railroad travel came along, you've heard of Sigmund Freud, all of you have, I'm sure. Well, his mentor, Jean-Martin Charcot at the Salpêtrière, used to suggest that his hysterical patients travel on the railroad over very bad roadbeds so that they would be bounced up and down. And one of the authors I read actually gives you instructions for how to arrange your legs as you're traveling, so that as to receive the maximum of vibration from the railway car. And of course, he does this under the guise of, you know, well, of course, these terrible women, why, this is what they do when they're riding in these rail cars. And he's quite detailed about it. I said, oh, thank you, I'll have to keep that in mind, you know. I took notes. It's in the book. I got the instructions. Okay. I also found another doctor in 1883, a fellow named Auguste Trépied. And he tells a whole medical conference, you know, guys, it's an orgasm, and we might as well just be upfront about it. And they all said, you know, we don't want to hear it, Auguste. And other people just said, no, the Cries of an Ariane, the hysterical paroxysm, nothing sexual is going on, and there can't be because there's no penetration. Right? It's merely massage of the external genitalia. And since there's no penetration, there's no sex. Right? Simple. Okay. The notions about women's orgasm have gone through a lot of changes during long periods in history. It's been thought that women had to have orgasms in order to conceive. But it wasn't, the doctors don't seem to have been all that clear what an orgasm was. Some of them seem to have confused orgasm with arousal, if you read the descriptions. Simply the engorgement of the genitalia is described as an orgasm. Well, if that's your definition of an orgasm and you think that that's what women need to conceive, why then you've got a kind of a frustrating definition as far as the women are concerned. Well, the next question I'm sure that's in all of your minds is, well, why didn't the women just do this themselves? Well, both men and women were taught until this century that masturbation was bad for them. And there were all kinds of theories about why it was bad. I think my personal favorite is the one about male semen, that it was the same as spinal column fluid, and that you would eventually just slump over and die. One of my favorite sources, Nicholas Cook, wrote a book in the 19th century called Satan in Society, and it went through, I forget, like 45 editions or something by the end of the 19th century. Very widely read. He has a description in there in which a guy actually dies in this massive whole body paroxysm. There's fluids leaking out of every conceivable orifice. And the doctor, of course, ascribes this, you know, to this little secret vice. And then he goes on to talk about, he thinks it causes menstrual cramps and sterility in women. So here are all these, you know, bugga things about, you know, bad things are going to happen to you if you masturbate. Sex with your husband is unsatisfying. So what are you going to do, right? You're going to go to the doctor. Okay. As long as the social camouflage was in place that this was a medical treatment, and that these doctors were merely doing their duty, you know, the doctors got away with it. And the thing that I find very interesting is there is no evidence, none at all, that doctors enjoyed doing this. And those of you who are male heterosexuals, you know, I mean, it sounds great at first. You think, oh, wow, what a way to make a living, right? No. I mean, first of all, they're not all going to be cute. You know, the second thing is, think about the danger of carpal tunnel syndrome. So these doctors really wanted to find another way to do this, and they wanted to do it more quickly. So the first technology that develops is water, pumped water. And we have some reason to think that that may have been used as early as Roman times, although the evidence is kind of equivocal. It's not really clear what's going on. We know that women were massaged to orgasm in the time of the Roman Empire because Juvenal is at great pains to tell us so. The women went to the bathhouses, and there were these beak-strapping young male masseurs with their vials of oil and their strigils. You know what a strigil is? It's a device for stimulating the skin. It looks a lot like a curry comb. If you've ever seen a curry comb for a horse, it's like a curry comb for a person. And they'd stroke you all over with that and rub you all over with oil, and they'd massage you from head to foot. And, of course, Juvenal thought this was terrible, and women should never, you know, do this. And, in fact, Saint Jerome, actually says in his book about all the do's and don'ts of Christianity, tells you that Christians should never bathe because it stirs up passions better left, you know, sleeping. That was the first technology, just pumped water. You remember that the water cure was very popular in the 19th century, and that women would go and be treated at spas like at Saratoga Springs and at Hot Springs, Arkansas. These were very popular, wildly popular. Well, there was something called the pelvic douche, which I'll show you in a minute, and you'll see why it was so popular. Those of you who own a shower massage already know why it was popular. And the second one that came along, brace yourselves, was the steam-powered vibrator of 1869. But this was awkward because you had to shovel coal into it. Just a minute, Mrs. Johnson, I have to go and shovel some more coal into the vibrator. Doctors really didn't like this device either because, first of all, you know, it's this huge capital-intensive machine. You have to install them. You have this big steam engine in one room, and then you have this drivetrain that extends into the next room where the patient is. And then the patient is lying on a table that's got a hole cut in it right over the pelvic region, and there's a wooden ball that's attached to the drivetrain to the next room, and the ball is... And the guy that invented this, George Taylor, he was called the manipulator. The guy that invented this machine had warned his fellow doctors that women, if you let them alone with this machine, would tend to overdo it. So you had to kind of control their use of it and not let them have it for more than 10 minutes at a time. So you see, this is a big productivity gain, right? You've already figured that out. You've gone from an hour, now we're down to 10 minutes. Well, next thing that comes along is the electromechanical vibrator, the true electromechanical vibrator of 1883. And you can get the job done now in like 5 to 8 minutes. So now things are really on the roll. And in fact, Albert Covey writes about the vibrator in 1906, says that what used to take an hour to accomplish can now be done in 5 to 10 minutes in the office without any skill at all. This is in a book called Profitable Office Specialties.
Rachel Maines, author of the book The Technology of Orgasm. Dr. Maines accompanied her lecture with a number of slides.
This is the pelvic douche of 1860. And this is the treatment that women got when they went to these spas with their problem of hysteria. About 4 minutes and you'll be cured of whatever ails you. And so it was a very popular treatment, as all of the spa doctors testify. This, by the way, I found in a book called Mechanization Takes Command by Siegfried Gideon, which historians of technology call, of course, Gideon's Bible. Sometimes it was felt that a little preparation was necessary. This is a water cure patient being flogged with a wet sheet before being set in for the douche, you know, just to kind of get the, you know, the circulation going, you know. Oh, and one of the doctors, George Taylor, the guy I told you about with the steam-powered vibrator, unfortunately, I don't have a slide of the steam-powered vibrator, he says that you have to explain to women what these strange feelings are that they will have, that these unexpected and incomprehensible feelings in the pelvis signal the return of health, and that you should tell them that, otherwise they'll be confused. There were some rather primitive efforts in the direction of jolting people on their pelvises. This is a jolting chair. You pull back on these two handles at the side of the chair, and the chair has huge springs underneath, and it bounces you right up into the air and back down onto your pelvis. You will eventually start to feel something, but it seems like your arms will get tired first. But these were sold for home use as well as for use in physicians' offices. Here's another experiment. This is about 1880. This is Dr. Butler's electromassage machine, a kind of a hybrid between electrotherapy and massage therapy. As you probably know, electricity was thought to have a healing effect all by itself. People would go and have very mild shock administered to various parts of their bodies. There were some men who actually wore electric belts, which were basically batteries, all the time, and it was to restore a vigor lost to secret vice. And here's a guy getting himself recharged here with Dr. Butler's electromassage machine. Interestingly, it's always men who are pictured in these books. You find very few, there are a few women, but mostly when you see nude pictures like this, it's always of men or semi-nude. This is the first known electromechanical vibrator. It's a little different from modern vibrators in some ways. This huge thing here is the battery. Look, it looks to me as if it must weigh about 30 pounds. It's a wet cell battery. Those of you who know anything about electricity will know that this is really an awkward device. There we go. Now, this is a personal favorite of mine. Partly it's the name, the Chattanooga vibrator. It's huge. You can't really tell how big it is here in this picture, but you'll see in a minute. This thing, in about 1904, sold for $200 at a period when you could buy a small house for $300. It was sold only to doctors, and they were very proud of that. The business end of it was up here, this sort of little rounded thing at the end. These are the handles that sort of hang down. The doctor would take hold of those and drive it around on the patient. I'll show you that in a minute. This thing here, believe it or not, is the counterweight. The box is the counterweight. The thing is so heavy that it would actually fall right over from being top heavy if it were not for that counterweight. And the only way you can move the thing around is on these little wheels. See, it's got little wheels. The doctor would push it around. They actually had vibratory operating rooms in which these things were used. Here we go. Here's the Chattanooga vibrator. And you notice I told you, men, it's usually men. And here we go. Here's a guy lying there. And the doctor has got a hold of the vibrator, which is on its little stand. The wheels are underneath this table, and he's pushing the vibrator around on the guy's body, just as he would be doing on a woman, except, of course, they never show you that. These things came with documentation, and if any of you are fans of pseudoscientific literature, the stuff that's in these books is just wonderful. The one in the middle is the one that goes with the Chattanooga vibrator, instructions for using it, and the one on the right is a French doctor who tells you how you can achieve longevity by using vibration. Here's old Mortimer Granville, who was an Englishman, and in his book he says, this very book that you see here in the slide, he says that he really strongly disapproves of using vibrators on women. He doesn't say why. He says he especially disapproves of using them on hysterics, and he never tells us why. We're supposed to already know. Now, this one that you're looking at here is a consumer model. Here's a slightly simpler one by the same manufacturer. This one is for alternating current. The introduction of alternating current, the kind of electricity came out of the wall, for a long time people were using devices that had to be plugged into the light socket. You know, so you get out your vibrator, climb on a chair, unscrew the light bulb, screw the vibrator into the light socket, you know, and then I suppose to use the vibrator in the dark. What other alternative was there? Anyway, this one was for AC. This was for line electricity. Whoops. These are the more sophisticated ones that were used by doctors on house calls. Now, I have a lot of questions about those house calls, but I've actually never read a description of one. But they carried these things around. This one you can see here is battery operated. It has electrodes as well as vibratory apparatus. And this one over here is strictly a vibratory device. They look a lot like hair dryers. You'll see, if you've ever seen hair dryers from the same period, they're made very much the same way. This is, I was telling you about this. This is the 1899 electrical massage machine, which was the first electromechanical vibrator that I've been able to find anyway, to be used in the home. And that you notice they have to explain to you that you're not going to be given an electrical shock. It's just going to vibrate. But you notice it's $5. And that's important to notice because doctors were charging at this time $2 to $3 a visit for these massage treatments. Now, of course, people made a lot less money. It's more money than it sounds like to us today. But if you're thinking about this, you know, well, okay, if I could go to the doctor three times at $2 a visit, then I have more, you know, if I buy one of these, then I can amortize the cost of the investment over 3 weeks, right? It's great. Doctors hated these things, these consumer models. This is another favorite of mine. Notice here that the idea is you buy a home motor. Here's the home motor. Sears and Roebuck, 1918, electrical goods for everyone, right? $8.75. But look what you can do with it. You can buy all these attachments. Churn and mixer, we've got a fan, household mixer, a beater, right? And a vibrator. It's a multitasking appliance. Isn't it wonderful? No home should be without one. They don't sell it anymore. There's no use your calling. This is the hydro massage, and this was something that you would not see nowadays because water is metered. You'll notice she's got a little tiny hydro turbine, just like the turbines that are under Travis Dam, except a lot smaller, attached to her faucet. And that is the source of power for the hydro massage vibrator. It's a water-powered vibrator. When water was first introduced into the home, it wasn't metered. You just paid a flat rate. And of course, what happened was that people used water as a power source, and then they had to start metering it because people were wasting it. I'm not sure it's wasteful to, well, never mind about that. Now, you have probably already thought about the fact that what these doctors are doing is producing orgasm for payment, right? What class of people do we associate with the production of orgasm for payment? It's not doctors. One of the things that I find interesting to think about in this connection is that there is an argument to the effect that prostitution is just in itself degrading. The production of orgasm for payment is in itself degrading, socially degrading, and morally degrading. And yet we have this class of an elite, a professional elite, that gets away with this century after century without losing any status at all. So then you have to ask yourself, you know, is it the definition of the task or the task itself? It looks to me as if it's the definition of the task, that women performing this task lose status and become socially degraded. Whereas when men are doing it inside this protective social camouflage that it's not really sexual, are rewarded and are continue to do it for 24 centuries without anybody even complaining about it, really. The doctors really feel like this is the received wisdom. You know, Galen tells us this, and therefore it's true. And you know, the women are supposed to evacuate these humors, because that's a big thing in Galenic medicine, that you accumulate these humors and you have to discharge them. There doesn't seem to be any kind of overarching theory other than Galenic medicine. Now, what happens at the end of the 20s as a couple of things happen. First of all, there's an increased understanding of women's sexuality. It becomes very difficult to argue that the hysterical paroxysm is anything but an orgasm. And the other thing that happens is that the vibrator begins to appear in stag films. And that makes it impossible to maintain this idea that, well, it's just a medical appliance. You're just a medical device that's being used for health. So it begins to disappear very quickly from these very respectable magazines that I'm showing you. As you can see, these are all very proper magazines, and these had these socially camouflaged ads. These were all perfectly consistent with this notion of passionlessness, because, don't forget, nothing sexual is going on here. It's all just for, you know, improving your circulation and making you feel better and treating your hysteria. Now, the American Psychiatric Association legislated hysteria right out of existence in 1952. It's no longer a legitimate medical diagnosis. And you think about this for a minute, and you consider that there's been such a diagnosis for 2,400 years, and you know that people thought there was really a disease, it makes you kind of wonder about some of the other disease paradigms we have, whether we're going to still have them 2,000 years from now.
Rachel Maines, author of the 1999 book, The Technology of Orgasm. Her research on the history of the vibrator has since been picked up for a documentary, a play, and now a feature film. On September 15, 2011, the film Hysteria debuted at the Toronto International Film Festival. It's a fictional Victorian-era love story between a feminist and the doctor who invents the motorized vibrator. We leave you with the film's star, Maggie Gyllenhaal, Canadian film columnist Johanna Schneller, and the director of Hysteria, Tanya Wexler, from the Toronto press conference.
You know, there's a kind of interest in this movie, like, oh, this is about vibrators and women's orgasms. And I don't think people really do talk about it very much. And I think it does still make us kind of flushed and uncomfortable. And I think that's the truth, right?
But there does seem to be an openness in discussing it. I don't know if you guys all saw Kirby Dick's documentary, This Film Is Not Yet Rated, talking about the rating system rating movies with sex scenes much harder than movies with violence, and particularly scenes in which women climax were seems to be the ones that automatically got an NC-17. Like, there's
really
nothing scarier in the world than a woman experiencing sexual pleasure. And I think you're getting around it by making it a comedy, which is one way of dealing with it.
You know, there's plenty of porn on the internet, and I think it's much more subversive to be able to make a film about the vibrator you can bring your mom to.
To hear this program again, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.